All right, welcome everybody to our January 4th masterclass. And first up, we have Sean Govazi. It is a recorded presentation, so we'll go ahead and get started.
Oh God. I broke it. I don't know how it works.
Down in the right-hand corner, there should be like a little icon that looks like a book. It'll go into presentation mode. At the bottom of your taskbar. Or you can go to slide at the top and slideshow.
Just hit from beginning.
From beginning. Yep, that'll work also.
Okay, cool. Can everybody see it?
We can still see it in the regular mode.
Okay, cool. I'm going to hit play because I don't know how to make it stop once I start it. So
go ahead and stop sharing for a second. Then go to the full mode, the beginning slide, or your screen.
It's breaking. It is just breaking itself, I think, because it won't stop playing. Did you want me to go ahead and start it?
Can't, are you sharing? Because I can't see anything.
No. Okay, I'll share it and then start it over.
Thank you, Zoe.
Problem.
We're not getting any sound if there is a sound.
Okay, hold on. You can't hear anything?
Yes, we can.
Okay.
When you first hit share on Teams, did you hit the share audio as well?
I didn't. I don't know how to do this, guys. I'm learning something completely new tonight. This is great.
Well, you're learning. We're learning.
Okay, time to start over.
Yeah, just.
Everybody goes through this the first time. Trust me.
Hey, at least I'm doing it now and not in like a real life job where people are like, you should know how to do this.
It's very true.
Okay, so you've got the right screen up now, but if you didn't share the audio when you did it, you'll have to stop the share and then share with audio that screen.
There we go. Question.
We got it.
AI can be defined as machines that are able to simulate human intelligence through carrying out functions that we normally perform using our brains to do so. AI essentially mimics the way we recognize and carry out thoughts to translate them into feasible actions. Some examples of application include chatbots, virtual assistants, social media algorithms, as well as facial recognition technology. AI can make educated guesses on outcomes based on their analysis of data inputs that they process rapidly to determine conclusions. They use algorithms to serve as rules that allow them to convert their fed data into usable information in order to be useful. How artificial intelligence works. You can see a diagram of the process here. It first receives an input. It then begins to learn patterns in order to create algorithms or rules. After that, it makes predictions using those rules it made. And finally, it performs tasks by processing all of the data into information. It becomes a feasible output. Here are three types of AI, each succeeding the last in measures of intelligence. The first one being machine learning, which involves the usage of data and algorithms in order to be able to imitate human behavior effectively. Next, we have neural networks, which are subsets of machine learning that imitates human neural nodes by using artificial neurons, simulating the brain's functions. It is also referred to as deep learning. The final one we have here is expert systems. Being the most advanced out of the three, it can simulate a human expert's decision regarding a certain field or particular subject, and it performs complex problem solving in doing so. AI tech.
I don't think there's sound for this slide.
Okay, you can. Are you advancing it each time?
Or is it automatic? Yeah, it makes me advance it each time.
Okay, well, go ahead.
Okay, even though this one doesn't have audio?
Yeah.
Okay.
AI technology segments. In the field of IT, we primarily concern ourselves with two types of AI technology. The first one being machine learning, which uses large amounts of data as a baseline of reference to learn to perform tasks faster and more accurately. Deep learning AI uses various media such as text, sound, and images in order to execute tasks effectively. Chatbots, facial recognition, and translators, such as Google Translate, are all examples of deep learning technology application. You give them images, sound, or text as input, and they respond with an output based on what was sent, based on the service. Two other segments that are listed below include natural language processing, which recognizes and applies human language, as well as computer vision that uses visual media to make suggestions or actions. Examples include virtual assistants and driverless cars, as well as emotional recognition on both of these. Here's a short video. It's a TED Talk by Brianna Brownell discussing how AI learns.
Today, artificial intelligence helps doctors diagnose patients, pilots fly commercial aircraft, and city planners predict traffic. But no matter what these AIs are doing, the computer scientists who designed them likely don't know exactly how they're doing it. This is because artificial intelligence is often self-taught, working off a simple set of instructions to create a unique array of rules and strategies. So how exactly does a machine learn? There are many different ways to build self-teaching programs, but they all rely on the three basic types of machine learning: unsupervised learning, supervised learning, and reinforcement learning. To see these in action, let's imagine researchers are trying to pull information from a set of medical data containing thousands of patient profiles. First up, unsupervised learning. This approach would be ideal for analyzing all the profiles to find general similarities and useful patterns. Maybe certain patients have similar disease presentations, or perhaps a treatment produces specific sets of side effects. This broad pattern-seeking approach can be used to identify similarities between patient profiles and find emerging patterns, all without human guidance. But let's imagine doctors are looking for something more specific. These physicians want to create an algorithm for diagnosing a particular condition. They begin by collecting two sets of data, medical images and test results from both healthy patients and those diagnosed with the condition. Then, they input this data into a program designed to identify features shared by the sick patients, but not the healthy patients. Based on how frequently it sees certain features, the program will assign values to those features' diagnostic significance, generating an algorithm for diagnosing future patients. However, unlike unsupervised learning, doctors and computer scientists have an active role in what happens next. Doctors will make the final diagnosis and check the accuracy of the algorithm's prediction. Then computer scientists can use the updated datasets to adjust the program's parameters and improve its accuracy. This hands-on approach is called supervised learning. Now let's say these doctors want to design another algorithm to recommend treatment plans. Since these plans will be implemented in stages, and they may change depending on each individual's response to treatment, the doctors decide to use reinforcement learning. This program uses an iterative approach to gather feedback about which medications, dosages, and treatments are most effective. Then it compares that data against each patient's profile to create their unique optimal treatment plan. As the treatments progress and the program receives more feedback, it can constantly update the plan for each patient. None of these three techniques are inherently smarter than any other. While some require more or less human intervention, they all have their own strengths and weaknesses, which make them best suited for certain tasks. However, by using them together, researchers can build complex AI systems where individual programs can supervise and teach each other. For example, when our unsupervised learning program finds groups of patients that are similar, it could send that data to a connected supervised learning program. That program could then incorporate this information into its predictions. Or perhaps dozens of reinforcement learning programs might simulate potential patient outcomes to collect feedback about different treatment plans. There are numerous ways to create these machine learning systems, and perhaps the most promising models are those that mimic the relationship between neurons in the brain. These artificial neural networks can use millions of connections to tackle difficult tasks like image recognition, speech recognition, and even language translation. However, the more self-directed these models become, the harder it is for computer scientists to determine how these self-taught algorithms arrive at their solution. Researchers are already looking at ways to make machine learning more transparent. But as AI becomes more involved in our everyday lives, these enigmatic decisions have increasingly large impacts on our work, health, and safety. So as machines continue learning to investigate, negotiate, and communicate, we must also consider how to teach them to teach each other to operate ethically. Today's computers can pilot spacecraft and perform surgery, but according to computer scientist Alan Turing, the real test of a computer's intelligence is basic small talk. Check out this video to find out why.
Here are three levels or stages of artificial intelligence that progress in complexity of intelligent behavior. Stage one is artificial narrow intelligence, also known as machine learning, mentioned previously, and is proficient in one area of particular interest and focusing on that associated problem with that area. Examples of applied machine learning that we all recognize today include Siri, Alexa, and Cortana digital assistants on our cell phones or smartphones, and various Internet of Things devices. Stage two is known as artificial general intelligence or machine intelligence, which occurs when a computer becomes as intelligent as a human in practicality. This gives it the ability to execute human-like tasks with little to no effort and fast results. Finally, artificial superintelligence is recognized as machine consciousness. At this point, The AI machine has surpassed human brain processing capabilities in about every aspect and can be applied in all fields nearly. I could feel, I could smell a new kind of intelligence across the table. Quote by Garry Kasparov, who became the first world chess champion to lose to a computer. He lost a chess match to an IBM supercomputer named Deep Blue on May 11th, 1997. Here is the significance of how AI will change IT. AI will change IT by being able to increase productivity and lessen the amount of human personnel needed for repetitive-oriented jobs, such as inspecting paperwork like resumes or forms for keywords or phrases. They also remove the element of error, as they are much more accurate and less prone to making mistakes whilst performing detailed-oriented tasks. Predictions using data input can help advise companies in making influential decisions ahead of time due to superior analytic capabilities. Big tech companies such as Google and Bing have implemented advanced AI into their services, such as ChatGPT, a natural language processing tool that can provide detailed brainstorm ideas for projects. Benefits of AI within IT. AI excels in departments where attention to detail is required, such as diagnosing cancers and other hidden diseases that are abstract in nature. AIs are consistent in giving results that are correct or mostly so, such as language translation. They do not have to sleep or eat and drink, so are able to be on the clock all the time, whilst human employees have breaks to take and set hours of operations or shifts, which allows AIs to serve as virtual agents 24/7 around the day. They are also effective in tailoring services to individual users to promote products or keep them on social media apps for longer amounts of time using algorithms based on what users like. Applying AI to IT. Here are some sectors where AI is applicable. Quality assurance and software testing. AI can reduce human error and test times while detecting problems easily and as soon as they arise, or even before they arise. Service management. AI can assure prompt delivery service as well as lowered costs for resources. Process automation involves repetitive tasks, and AI can reduce manual labor as well as costs here and enhance business function through analysis of trends. Quality assurance. This dives deeper into the ways AI can guarantee quality assurance. One way is app testing. AI can use location, device, and demographics criteria to make test suites based on users' behaviors to improve application functions as well as customer satisfaction. Social media analysis allows large data to be broken down in order to potentially foresee future market trends and even predict future user behaviors in order to retain their attention longer on applications. Defect analysis allows detection of errors or vulnerability along with solution generation. Efficiency analysis supports quality assurance engineers in making more informed decisions through providing them with multi-source researched info. Going into service management, AI can provide a self-solving service desk for troubleshooting tickets as an automated IT support provider. Here, it is able to study company input data, suggest real user solutions based on ticket database, as well as track user behavior and present self-help options. Machine learning and deep learning allow in recognizing same issues from the past and providing solutions based on older requests. Business strategy and operational efforts are also influenced in this area by AI. Thank you all for attending my masterclass. I appreciate your time. Let me know if there are any questions.
Okay. Good job, Zoe. Thank you, Sean, for that great presentation. Sorry, there's a train running right past me, of course. I'm outside. Zoe, do you want to go ahead and get yours ready?
Yeah. Okay. How do I work this? Okay, this is going to be stupid question number two. How do you work PowerPoint?
So you can do the same thing with your with yours. Do the slideshow and then beginning.
So it starts over here and then... Because it keeps throwing this screen.
Yeah, you probably need to stop sharing and then have the large screen and then reshare and share that screen if you've got multiple screens.
Oh, okay. There we go.
There you go. Good job.
Okay, so now that we have all my technical issues out of the way, I'm doing my presentation on just different hats of a hacker. So why is it important to know this information? Knowing the different types of hackers out in the world and their capabilities can help in understanding different attack methods and how to avoid those attacks. It also brings an understanding to basic motives of the attacker, just because not everybody has the same motives. The different hat colors, these are the more known ones, is the white hat, blue hat, gray hat, red hat, black hat, and the green hat hackers. And they all kind of do different things while also doing the same thing. So the most known hackers and their motives. So the white hat hackers are the good guys. They're the ones that are hired by companies to do testing and always have owner's permission to use the systems. They're more known for being ethical and they stay within legal parameters. The black hat hackers, those are the really bad guys. So those are the ones that are hacking for financial gain, achieve goals, usually work for the black market. Most of these guys are using their skills to exploit individuals and companies, and they never have permission for access, and it is always illegal what they do. Gray hat hackers do walk a fine line on the law. They do certain things that'll draw attention to vulnerabilities, and then they'll offer services to fix those vulnerabilities. They do bad things by penetrating the systems. They don't usually do harm to the system, but you shouldn't be accessing people's stuff without permission. Kind of the standpoint. The lesser known hackers and their motives. So you have your green hat hackers. These are the newbie hackers. They don't know much about what they're doing and aren't aware of potential consequences of their actions. Typically, they don't know how to repair damage they cause. Sometimes they care and sometimes they don't care about the damages that they have caused. They usually don't do things illegally unless they're approved to do it by the system owner they're attempting to hack, which are usually when they're doing training. Red hat hackers, these are what I call the not so bad guys going after the really bad guys. Their actions, while noble, are hardly ever ethical, and they take illegal routes to complete their tasks, which usually include like hacktivists, people that try to exploit the bad guys, like the worst guys. And then the blue hat hackers, there's two personalities. There's the ones that are hired by companies to test outside vulnerabilities for new products or before they release a different part of a product. And then personality two, usually they have their own motives and take personal revenge, and most of the time what they're doing is also illegal. So a little more into like the two personalities of the blue hats. So you'll hear one personality being called the outside security professionals. Typically, they're thought of as an outside contracted employee. A company will invite this hacker to test a system they're going to be updating or a new system they're releasing. This allows for contract work to be happening. So, you know, if you go on Indeed, you'll see like contract work for penetration testing. These are the people that they're talking about. And then the revenge seekers, these people take revenge for a person, an employer, really anybody they feel is done wrong. And sometimes they'll use malware to cause damage to the systems, even if they don't really want any like gain from it other than to just do harm. So it's not very fun. So one thing that's kind of more common is a script kiddie. So the difference between a green hat and a script kiddie is a green hat hacker is somebody that is trying to learn how to hack, and they aren't usually trying to do it illegally or cause damage. And when they do cause damage and they find out about it, most of the time, can't speak for everyone, they want to fix it and they want to discover issues they've caused, how to avoid them, that kind of stuff. Script kiddies, they don't usually care about damage they caused. They'll purchase pieces of code or malware to launch attacks to systems. They really just do it to show off and obtain attention. They don't have any other purpose other than to look cool. So they're kind of usually bunched together, which is why I'm separating them, because they are not the same thing. Other common types of hackers are hardware hackers, network hackers, and social engineering hackers. Hardware hackers, it's anybody attempting to get inside of a digital infrastructure by manipulating a device or server physically. A network hacker obtains access to a system wirelessly by entering the network through a series of attacks. And then a social engineering hacker, these are the ones that are going to be more internal threats, because there'll be people that are individuals or groups that trick others into giving them information to access a system or break through a firewall. So not only could they be doing it by sending you a weird message on Facebook and you reply to it and click on it or anything like that, but it could also be somebody that you scan your card, walk into a building, and they walk in with you. And that is another way that people will just use social engineering as an attack. So ways to protect yourself. Passwords, use a strong password and change them often. You don't have to change them, you know, every week, but every couple months would be good. And most companies will also send alerts to their employees to change your passwords. Any suspicious activity you want to investigate, and if you're able to report it, like at work, do that, because that means it's not just an attack on you, but your work network. And avoid any questionable websites, and don't click on emails that look suspicious, like phishing emails. Antivirus is a really big one. You can use antivirus systems on all technology to help avoid cyber attacks. So that's anywhere from smartphones to tablets and computers. A big one that I found out recently was these new LeapPad devices that kids have that actually they can like go onto the internet. I learned that from one of my nannying jobs. So that was an interesting one. They put antivirus on it. So the summary, with technology taking the world by storm, there are now more cyber threats than ever before. Part of staying protected is learning what the threats are that are out there. Basically, stay informed and stay safe. And that is all. Thank you.
Nice job. One thing I didn't know was the green hat. I did not know that was a thing. I knew the other ones, but good knowledge. Thank you.
Yeah. What's up, Kayla? Is
our hand. Someone have a question?
Yes, there's no hands.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Well, good job. Thank you. It looks like on the sheet, the last person also has a recording. Do you see that also, Zoe?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you help me with that one when we get there?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay. See, now you're a pro, so you got this. See? I believe Cam is next. You ready?
Yep. Hope everybody's ready for containers. Not sure how familiar everybody is. Can everybody see my screen all right?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Perfect. So containers are a standardized unit of software for packaging code and its dependencies together. They're lightweight, standalone, executable packages of software. They include all the dependencies like code, runtime, system tools, system libraries, and settings. And they're considered a form of operating system virtualization that split the OS into two main parts, which is the application code and dependencies, as well as the operating system kernel. Then images become containers at runtime, and multiple containers can then be deployed as one or more clusters. And containers are well known for being able to isolate software from the infrastructure that way. And here we've got a couple different, we've got three different containerization services and an orchestration service. We have Docker, which was launched in 2013 and really brought most of the attention to containerization. They expanded on concepts from Linux like C groups, namespaces, and jails. They use images such as copy on write snapshots. And actually, Docker donated runtime code called RunC, which is written in Golang, to the Open Container Initiative to establish standardization, but it does lack general Windows support. From there, the Open Container Initiative acts as the baseline runtime that creates and runs your containers. And there's also the Container Runtime Interface, which focuses on orchestration. They used to use Docker Shim, but it's more recently been replaced by Containerd. And then Red Hat actually offers an alternative called Cryo, C-R-I-O, which is a lightweight alternative to Docker and is an implementation of the Kubernetes Container Runtime Interface. Go back real quick. We've got LXC, which is Linux containers. It's an open source vendor neutral container runtime, and it actually operates under the hood of Docker and behind the scenes. And then we have Rocket, which is a security first container system, which seeks to address underlying issues with containers like cross-contamination, which we'll get into in a little bit here, and does not actually allow insecure functionality unless the user explicitly enables it, but it's no longer actively developed on GitHub, but it can be forked and developed to individual needs. And another sort of highlight of it is that there's no central daemon. It uses pods, which are typically several containers, and they run directly as isolated Unix processes. And then Kubernetes is an orchestration platform which recognizes multiple runtime environments like Docker and manages considerations like infrastructure resources such as CPU, storage, and networking. And it allows for easier automation and scaling, but it does have a bit of a learning curve. From there, we kind of get into the comparison of virtual machines versus containers, which virtual machines are an abstraction of physical hardware, including a full copy of the operating system, which you can see across here. Also includes applications, necessary binaries, and it provides abstraction as well as emulation, but virtual machines are much denser and typically take tens of gigabytes. Containers, on the other hand, virtualize the software level and reside just above the host operating system and the containers will actually share the host operating system. They isolate processes in the user space, and more often than not, they're typically only tens of megabytes in size, but they're not quite the same as virtualization. VMs provide servers and computers, where containers provide applications as instances without emulation. Some of the benefits are that they're pretty portable. Containers are like small pluggable units. They're pretty well suited to microservice architecture. They're designed to be platform independent, so they can run on Linux or Windows. They're also very scalable. Due to their lightweight, they can spin up and down pretty quickly. And with orchestration like Kubernetes, you can automate spinning up more or spinning down containers to allow for load balancing as needed during high volume times. You get isolation with containers running in their own environment. Each container has its own file system, network stack, and processes. And they allow for project abstraction, so you can separate, say, application development and infrastructure development to allow both sides to work independently without negatively impacting the other and breaking the other's code. They're very consistent. Once you create an image, you can then transfer that image across different platforms and run it regardless of the base operating system, and allow for a smoother transition between development and production. And due to their lightweight, they're very efficient. They have a particularly low CPU, compute, and memory utilization. And since they share the host operating system, you don't have to dedicate, say with virtual machines, how you devote a certain number of cores and a certain amount of memory. You can run several containers and they'll all live off of the host operating system and only take what they need. Some of the drawbacks, though, is security-wise, even though they're isolated, they still share the same host kernel. So any vulnerabilities that exist for the host can still affect the containers. And from there, once the container's compromised, there's the risk of the compromise breaking out and affecting other containers or the host itself. There's a few mitigations you can use, like trusted images, limiting features, access privileges, limiting which ports are exposed, and even limiting the ability to change a container once it's been launched. There's a few other steps you can take, like creating separate virtual networks for containers, and generally the best practice is to use thin, short-lived containers and to replace those containers once you implement a change. That said, as much benefit as they bring, they can be kind of complex to learn at first, particularly orchestration. They're very difficult in large-scale environments without orchestration. And in production environments, you may need hundreds to thousands of separate containers to meet business needs. But a few of the options for orchestration are Docker Compose, which is focused on one host running multiple containers. You have Docker Swarm, which runs multiple containers across multiple hosts. And you have Kubernetes, which has more of a focus on extensibility and provides more granular control. Storage-wise, they're stateless by default, so there's no permanent storage or preservation of state. Anytime you spin it back down, all your data is lost for that session. But you can add persistent volumes in order to store data, such as if you're running a database in a container. Networking typically requires a bit of careful planning and management, particularly when communicating across multiple hosts and environments. And compatibility-wise, containers are specific to their runtime. Applications packaged in one container format may not run on a different runtime, but there are some conversion tools available. And then some common uses. These are all different vendors that use, they're all Docker partners. So some common uses are serverless open source frameworks. You have Lift and Shift, operations where companies focus on migrating legacy applications to modern environments, but that doesn't typically take full advantage of the benefits offered by a modular container-based architecture. There's refactoring, where you completely rework a program into a container native development, and then there's a full container native development. Then another common use is for continuous integration and deployment, which supports streamlined builds, tests, and deployments from the same images. It facilitates easier version controls and allows for faster change implementation, like additional features or security fixes, without necessarily sacrificing the quality offered, the quality of service. And containerized infrastructure can help companies to bridge the gap to reaching enterprise-level microservices. Then, getting started, you'll choose your runtime. So in my case, I used Docker Desktop, and each runtime will provide their own instructions for how you get it set up and getting started. And from there, you can check out a image registry such as Docker Hub, which provides thousands of different container images. So you've got BusyBox, you have Python, there's MongoDB, and you can actually even run Docker within Docker containers if you're doing Docker development. And oftentimes, such as with this Apache instance, they provide all the instructions you need to where you can just copy paste and get a container up and running. And then each image registry, like Docker Hub, has a repository, which is the specific location of the image within the registry and contains the latest image as well as version history. From there, you're ready to start building your image. So in this case, I took the previous code that was on the Apache instance, and I used a template website from, I believe it's CSS. I'll come back to that, but we have the Docker file, which you can follow the instructions from the page on Docker Hub to create. And then you execute the corresponding build command. If you end up with any errors, you can typically Google or find from the error code itself exactly what the problem is. And then once you get it set up and you get the container built, you can configure your final details, such as the specific container name for that instance, which host ports you want to expose, if you have any persistent volumes or environmental variables. And once you've done all that, you can run, and now you've got a website that's ready to go. Perfect in a container, and you can run it locally, or you can distribute it across multiple systems, such as Azure or Amazon Web Services, and now anybody can access it. And that's it. Anybody have any questions?
Great job.
Thank you.
Anybody have any questions?
Go ahead, Giselle.
Yeah, I took a class of containers a while ago, and I was very confused. It's very hard to understand. When I think of containers, is it it works kind of like the cloud?
Yeah, containers are most often seen in cloud deployments because you can create the same application that can run across different servers. So when you access a website, for example, you might not be accessing the same server every time. You might be accessing a container that's running that website on any number of different servers.
Okay. Thank you. Great job, no problem. Though.
Thank you.
Nice job. And I think I took you guys out of order, so I guess we'll go back to Trevor. Oh, that was Trevor. Wait, is the order right on the thing?
I think we've been following the order.
Okay, Cam is up. Sorry.
Next to me?
Yep, you're next.
Okay. Okay, let me share my screen first. Screen window. Screen. Why it's not showing this entire screen? Screen one. Can you see my screen?
Yes, we can.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, now. Okay, now I'm going to start now. First, I wanted to express my sincere gratitude to the management team leads, and all those associated with this course. I'm thankful for being assigned the presentation on January 25th. Leveraging the winter break, I dedicated my time to in-depth research, starting from scratch. I'm excited to share that I have completed the presentation ahead of schedule, and I'm ready to present it 2 weeks earlier. I trust the presentation will provide a valuable understanding of protecting children's privacy rights online and the need for it governance. I'll give a little small background for the topics right now. I divided these topics into parts, like protecting children's privacy rights online. A complete strategy involving awareness and education is necessary to address the essential aspect of safeguarding children's privacy online. Firstly, educating parents and guardians about the significance of online privacy for children is essential. This involves imparting knowledge about the potential risks and threats prevalent in the digital space. To empower parents further, the promotion and encouragement of parental control tools and setting of device and online platform becomes essential. Providing
accessible. Cam, can I interrupt for just a second? I don't think we're seeing your slides. We can just see the front, the introduction.
Oh, just can you I'm talking about.
Okay.
We're
not seeing the presentation view. Can you go to slideshow up at the top and go to beginning? And then we'll be able to see the full slide. That's what I meant. But we're in the creating mode instead of the presentation mode.
Oh.
Up at the top there it says slideshow on the on the left on the top on the you should see slideshow.
Yes.
There you go. Yeah. And then it'll say from the beginning on the left. Once you click on it, you should see from the beginning.
Okay, from the beginning. I can see the from the beginning here. Mm-hmm. Where is that button? Slideshow here.
There you go. Now on the left-hand side of the toolbar, you should see from beginning. There you go.
Okay, and now is it okay?
Yeah, it's fine. You can go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, just I'm talking about the topics. Okay. And the parents understanding and effectively implement control over their children online activities at once, advocating for creating and enforcing age appropriate content guidelines is important. This ensures that platform prioritize filtering content suitable for different age groups, promoting a safer online environment. Additionally, organizing workshops for children to educate them about online safety practices and collaborating with school and communities to integrate with such education into the curriculum forms and proactive approach toward fostering a secure digital space for the younger generation. And the need for IT governance. Organization must establish and strictly enforce strong data protection policies to strengthen the security and integrity of sensitive information, particularly that of minors. This involves ensuring compliance with data protection regulation and standard, thereby creating a safeguard against potential privacy breaches, conducting regular risk assessment in paramount to identify weakness IT system. Organizations can mitigate risks and enhance overall cybersecurity strength by implementing proactive measures. Employee training is an essential component involving staff education on IT security protocols and best practices. Fostering a culture of cybersecurity awareness within the organization ensures that every team members actively contribute to the protection of sensitive data. Establishing a comprehensive incident response plan is essential for promptly addressing and mitigating a cybersecurity incident. Regular testing and update of this plan are imperative to adapt to the evolving landscape of cyber threats. Collaborating with law enforcement agencies and regulatory bodies is another essential aspect of effective IT governance. This collaborative effort addresses cybersecurity, cybercrime, and ensure ongoing compliance with evolving regulation. Staying informed about legal development related to IT governance completes the holistic approach to safeguarding data and maintaining a strong cybersecurity position. So this is the topics. Okay, now I'm going to.
What is the children's online?
It is going directly. Okay. And the second slide. Okay, first there is a small video and after that I'll discuss about this one.
What is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998 or COPPA? In this video, we will try to understand that. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998 is a United States federal law. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998 or COPPA protects the privacy of children aged less than 13 years. As per the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998 or COPPA, a company needs to post its privacy policy online. If a company is collecting data from children younger than 13 years, then the company needs to obtain parental consent. If a company is collecting data from children less than 13 years, then the company needs to notify the parents about the information being collected. A company that collects personal data of children under 13 years can retain the collected data as long as necessary to fulfill the purpose and then delete it afterward. If a company or organization collects data from children younger than 13 years, and does not comply with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998, the impact may be severe. For example, in 2016, a well-known mobile advertising company tracked the location data of children younger than 13 years using its advertising software and failed to comply with the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act of 1998 or COPPA. As a result, the company had to face a hefty fine. So, although children under 13 years can give their personal information with their parents' consent, some companies disallow children under 13 years from using their services altogether because of the cost and work involved in complying with the law. I hope this helps. Interested viewers who want to know more, please visit the website of the security body or refer.
Okay, so protecting children's privacy rights online and the need for IT governance and the first understanding online privacy. So online privacy is a fundamental right to control the information shared and determine who can access it and when using the internet. This right is especially critical for children, as their data can be exploited for harmful purposes, including identity theft, cyberbullying, and exposure to inappropriate content. In today's digital age, protecting children's online privacy is challenging and essential. Children's increasing internet use for education, entertainment, and social interaction requires strong measures. Through the formulation of policies, practices, and technologies, IT governance plays a vital role in justifying the privacy risks children face online. Next. Sorry.
What is the children's online privacy?
When it comes to information that companies collect online from kids under 13, parents should be in control. That's the thinking behind the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act and the COPPA rule. The rule has been in place for years, but the Federal Trade Commission, the nation's consumer protection agency, has revised COPPA to keep pace with technology. If your company has been complying with COPPA, the basics still apply. You still have to give notice to parents and get their verifiable consent before you collect, use, or disclose personal information from children under 13. You still have to keep kids' information secure. And the revised COPPA rule retains safe harbor provisions so that groups can submit programs for FTC approval. But five key changes to COPPA take effect July 1st, 2013. Here's what your business needs to know.
I'm Peter McGee, an attorney with the FTC. So what's new about COPPA? The first important change is that the FTC has revised some definitions to expand who's covered by COPPA and the kinds of information that require companies to comply with the rule. The rule has always applied if you operate a website, an online service, or an app directed to children under 13. It also applies if you have a site, a service, or an app directed to a general audience and you have actual knowledge that you're collecting personal information online from kids in that under 13 age group. Revisions to the rule make it clear that COPPA also covers an operator of a child-directed site or service where it allows outside services, like plugins or advertising networks, to collect personal information from visitors. In addition, if a plugin or ad network has actual knowledge that it's collecting personal information through a child-directed site or service, the plugin or ad network is covered by COPPA too. The upshot, the rule applies to companies that may be new to COPPA compliance. The FTC also has revised the definition of the types of information COPPA covers. The rule has always applied if companies collect certain kinds of personal information from kids under 13, like their first and last name, a home address, a phone number, an email address, online contact information, or a screen or username that functions as online contact information. But the FTC has clarified that definition. The COPPA rule covers geolocation information that can identify a street name and the city or town. And we've expanded the rule to include photos, videos, and audio files that contain a kid's image or voice as well. Something else covered under the revised COPPA rule, persistent identifiers that can be used to recognize a user over time and across different sites or online services. But there's a notable exception here. COPPA's parental notice and consent requirements don't apply if the identifier is used just to support your site's internal operations. Take a look at the rule for more about the meaning of internal operations in this context. Another change to COPPA relates to what operators need to tell parents. It's still the law that you have to notify parents directly and get their verifiable consent before collecting personal information online from their kids. But now you need to know to put certain key pieces of information up front within the notice you send. You'll want to read the rule for the specifics, but the big picture is that it's not enough just to give parents a link to something on your site and expect them to figure things out for themselves. This change will make it easier for parents to get the important details they need when they need them. The rule also streamlines what you have to include in your online privacy policy about your information practices. The third change involves new ways to get the parental consent COPPA requires. In addition to the methods already in the rule, including FTC-approved safe harbor programs, COPPA now gives businesses more ways to get a parent's okay. For example, electronic scans of signed consent forms, video conferencing, the use of government-issued IDs, and alternative payment systems, assuming they meet the same stringent criteria as credit cards. The sliding scale mechanism of parental consent, often called Email Plus, is still an acceptable method for operators that collect personal information just for their own internal use. Technology changes quickly, so to encourage innovation in this area, the revised rule sets up a voluntary process for businesses to get FTC approval for other methods of parental consent. The fourth change strengthens provisions for keeping kids' information confidential and secure. Under the revised rule, operators must take reasonable steps to make sure that before releasing information to service providers or other third parties, those companies are capable of maintaining the confidentiality, security, and integrity of the information. It's not enough if they just talk the talk. You also need to get assurances they'll follow through. Under COPPA, you can retain kids' personal information only as long as it's reasonably necessary. And when you dispose of it, you have to take reasonable steps to protect against unauthorized access. The fifth change to COPPA deals with additional monitoring of self-regulatory safe harbors. The new rule strengthens the FTC's oversight of safe harbor programs. It requires them to audit members and report the combined results of those audits to the FTC every year.
Okay, I divided the some key aspect of protecting children's privacy rights online and the need for IT governance. So number one, legal framework and regulation, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA. Government worldwide have recognized the importance of protecting children online and have implemented various law and regulation. For example, in the United States, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, sets rule for collecting personal information from children under 13. And IT governance helps organizations comply with this regulation by implementing and enforcing policies that align with legal requirement. Next. Aspect number two, age verification and parental consent. IT governance framework can include measures for age verification and obtaining parental consent before collecting personal information from children. These ensure that parents know and agree to their child's online activities. And number three, education and awareness. IT governance should focus on educating parents, guardians, and children about the importance of online privacy. This includes raising awareness about potential risks, responsible online behavior, and the significance of protecting personal information. And here is the short video.
Today is my birthday. I'm going to post a story. Let's meet outside school. Happy birthday. Selfie? Yeah. Hey guys, let's shoot some hoops. Basketball court at 4. I'll be waiting for you at my place to celebrate. This is my address and my phone number. Happy birthday, David. You're very popular, aren't you? You have lots of friends. You use chats and social media all the time. They know everything about you. What you like, when your birthday is, who your friends are, the sport you play. But they could also know your phone number and where you live. Have you ever thought that what you share online could be read by someone that is not so much of a friend? Always remember to take great care with the personal information and photos that you share online. Share with care. Now let's go celebrate. Your friends are waiting for you. Remember, pictures and information that you post or send can be easily reshared by others. So they could remain online for a very long time. Be careful when posting. Don't share phone numbers, addresses, or personal details. This information could be misused by others. Always check your privacy settings of the apps you use. It's important to know what people can see or who can contact you. When signing into a website or social media, ask an adult for help and advice. Choose a difficult password and share it only with your parents. Take great care with everything you share online. If you have any doubts, always ask an adult for help.
Number four aspect, privacy by design. Implementing privacy by design principle is essential in IT governance. This involves integrating privacy consideration into developing online platform and services. Ensuring privacy is not an addition. Number five aspect, data minimizing and purpose limitation. IT governance should enforce principle of data minimization and purpose limitation. Only the minimum amount of personal information necessary for a specific purpose should be collected, and that data should not be used for other purpose without a proper consent. And number six, security measures. Strong cybersecurity measures are essential for protecting children's personal information. IT governments should mandate the implementation of encryption, secure data storage, and access controls to prevent unauthorized access to sensitive information. Next. And seven, monitoring and compliance audits. Regular monitoring and compliance audits are essential component of IT governance. Organizations should regularly assess their practices, ensure ongoing compliance with privacy regulation and standards. Number eight, international collaboration. Given the global nature of the internet, international collaboration is important. IT governance should facilitate cooperation between organizations, government, and NGOs to address cross-border privacy issue and share best practices. In conclusion, Protecting children's online privacy requires a comprehensive approach involving legal compliance, technological measures, education, and contribution. Continuous monitoring. IT governance is the foundation for implementing and sustaining effective privacy protection mechanism in the digital land. Online privacy requires a comprehensive approach involving. I think this is the last. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good job. Lots of interesting stuff there.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's a broad thing. So. And it is useful topics also.
Right. Any questions? Okay, good job. All right, Giselle, you're up.
Okay. Let me go ahead and share my screen. Can you see my screen?
Not yet.
Okay.
Okay, now we can see it.
Okay. Okay. So my topic is artificial intelligence system for dental diagnosis with CBCT 3D scan. Okay, my agenda is as follows. What is a combined compute tomography and how it works? When and why CBCT? Importance of CBCT in dentistry. Artificial intelligence has impacted dentists' life with the CBCT technology. And CBCT images versus 2D x-ray. Introduction. Radiology plays a crucial role in the dental patient's diagnostic evaluation. Ever since CT was introduced as a clinical technique, there has been interest in 3D diagnostic imaging of the jaws. The application of this technology in the dental field has been restricted due to its high dosage, relatively costly, and restricted availability to hospitals and medical radiology offices. What is a CBCT and how it works? So my next slide will, I presented a video so it can explain to you guys better and more much understanding.
Tomography, or CBCT, is a medical imaging device that generates three-dimensional images.
Can barely hear it. Can hear it, but barely.
Okay, let me see. Wait.
Of interest. This produces a series of two-dimensional images which are reconstructed in 3D using a specific computer program. This technique allows for greater detail and a lower absorbed dose of radiation compared with that of conventional medical CT scans. The CBCT scans allow us to view slices of the teeth and supporting structures in three separate planes. The sagittal plane, where we're moving from ear to ear. The coronal plane, where we're moving from the back of the head to the nose. and the axial plane, where in this case we're moving from the chin up to the top of the head. These images allow us to diagnose and treat more accurately, efficiently, and effectively than ever before. Sonography, or CBCT, is a medical...
Okay, so basically, the video that I just showed you guys basically explain a little bit of this that I'm going to say right now, in case you didn't hear much. It's a form of diagnostic imaging test called a cone beam compute tomography, creates comprehensive three-dimensional pictures of the body interior components using sophisticated computer technology and cone-shaped X-ray beams. Doctors may identify and arrange therapies for a variety of medical issues with the use of CBCT scans, which are safe, non-invasive, and somewhat rapid tests. Orthopedics, dentistry, and other medical specialties that need precise imaging of tiny body parts frequently employ CBCT scans. The CBCT systems rotate around the patient in approximately 30 seconds, capturing data using a cone-shaped X-ray beam. When and why CBCT? Doctors require CBCT scan when standard two-dimensional dental X-rays are insufficient. Dental CBCT is employed. To compare to a traditional CT scan, CBCT offers clinicians more comprehensive 3D images of the face with less radiation exposure. This might be useful for some diseases evaluation, diagnosis, and treatment planning. The importance of CBCT in dentistry. A CBCT scan uses a particular type of imaging technology to capture 150 plus images of your mouth at different angles. These images are then digitally compile into one three-dimensional images. Over here in this picture that I am pointing to, this is a AI generated. In this case, the patient needed implants on their bone, and the doctor used the generated AI. So a little help so they can tell the doctor where to place the implants where you have enough bones and it's more accurate. On this image over here, these are implants, and this doctor didn't use the 3D CBCT scan, and he assumed that this patient had enough bone over here, so he placed an implant here. But what he didn't know was that the implant was going to collapse and going to fail because the bone was not very strong there. So as you can see here, the implant, it's sideways, so it failed. On this images that I'm showing you here, should this patient save this tooth? So this is a 2D image, X-ray image, and this is the 3D imaging. Over here in the 2D imaging, when a doctor sees 2D X-ray right here, they can see that something is going on. What a dentist look for on an X-ray is dark shadows. Dark shadows means infection, and it can mean fractures and things like that. So over here, you can see that there's something going on here because it's a little dark, but that's it, nothing else. With the 3D imaging AI generated, you can see more clearly here that this patient has a infection here going alongside of the root, which can mean a fracture, which can mean a resorption on the teeth, And in this case, this patient is going to need an extraction, and it's not safe, it's not worth saving the tooth, which in this 2D imaging, they couldn't diagnose that. So if the patient would save the tooth with a root canal, it might be felt in the future. In these images, should this patient save the tooth? So right here, again, we're looking for dark shadows. In this 2D image, you can hardly see dark shadows here. You can probably see something here, and that's it. So there's nothing, like if a dentist sees this, they're going to be say, okay, something is going on here, but we're not clear enough unless we have a CBCT scan, which in this case, over here, you can see the dark shadow really clearly because of the help with the AI. So the answer is yes. The doctor decided to save this tooth. He went back to look at the scan, and he decided that it was not a fracture and it could be saved. So after the root canal was done, this was the pre-op of the imaging, and this was the 6 months after. So over here, you can see 6 months after that there's bone generated in around the roots, which means the infection, it's gone and it's healing. Artificial intelligence has impacted dentist life with the CBCT technology. AI plays a very important role when treatment planning for patients' needs and desire using the CBCT scan. The advancements of science and technology has brought innovations in the dental field. Both diagnosis and treatment have been dramatically changed by the invasion of imaging technology. Cone beam compute tomography enables 3D skeletal dental analysis for treatment plans in orthodontics, prosthodontics, periodontics, and orthognathic surgery. In summary, it is vital to any clinician to remain in touch with latest innovation in the field of one's expertise and apply the same for the benefit of patient care and be ready and willing to accept new trends. CBCT is one such recent advancement in the field of dentistry, which one should learn and adapt into clinical practice. Thank you. Hope you guys enjoyed the presentation. Any questions?
Great job. Very interesting. I learned so much in these sessions, I swear. Go ahead.
I was going to say, so how is the AI working? Is this a regression, a clustering? What exactly are they doing? Because this is a stack of 2D images. And so I'm very curious about how this is actually going on.
So the AI comes to work when for diagnostic purposes. So if a patient comes in the office and with a 2D imaging, they can only see a two-dimensional image, which is a flat image. With the 3D.
What you explained was is that this is a collection. The tomography is a collection of 2D images that are stacked to create a pseudo 3D rendering.
Yes.
And so my question is, so what is then inputted into the AI? I'm probably getting more detail here than you probably are familiar with, but I'm interested in this.
So the AI, my understanding of the AI, because I work in the dental field. So when we treatment planning for a patient, the AI generates the treatment for the patient. Implants, extractions, root canals, and other treatments that you guys might be familiar with or not. But the AI helps the dentist generate a better treatment plan. And that's all about the AI and the CBCT scan. That's my understanding of the two.
Do you know if it was supervised or unsupervised learning?
I don't know if they were supervised or unsupervised learning. I don't know that part, but all I know, but all I know is that our dentists and a lot of dentists out there, they use the AI system for diagnosis.
Yeah, I imagine it's probably supervised.
Do you mean like was the machine learning how to develop the AI resolution?
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, how did it know what to do? And that's my question.
I'm assuming it's supervised. I'm going to go ahead and do my research on that. But I'm assuming it's supervised because
that's what I would assume.
When it comes to health and getting a diagnostic for a patient and, you know, life or death, I'm assuming that if you're counting with a CBCT scan for diagnosis, I'm assuming it's supervised.
Great talk.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good job.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have one more. Nikki, you're here, right? You finished your class?
Yes, okay. We finished orientation and everybody is here.
She should be here.
Okay. Awesome. So we still have Landry's presentation. Zoe, could you present Landry's?
Yes, I can.
Awesome. See, now that you're the expert, we're going to go to you now.
I mean, I wouldn't call myself that, but...
Also, Professor Landon, to answer your question on that machine, because I've had many scans with that particular machine. They're very supervised as far as determining the overall procedure that needs to be done. And then with the technology involved, it crashes all the time because it's still so new. But whenever it scans your mouth, it gives like a 3D model as well that you can look in like a system kind of like CAD and look at it like that.
Yeah. So the supervision aspect was here is a 3D model and this was the outcome and that's supervised. Otherwise, unsupervised machine learning is going to be here's a bunch of things. You figure out the rules, computer.
Yeah.
So like, I imagine it was probably supervised because that would make sense in the healthcare profession.
Yeah, because when I had it done, they had to take measurements of like my jaw and stuff like that before they could.
And then they're going to need to know, you know, were there any issues in order to put you into what group you had to be in the learning data set.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah. And then they knock you out and do their job, which was my favorite part.
Yeah.
Well, that's not the AI doing that.
Yeah. No, that is the lovely doctor.
Wait till the robots start doing that.
Yeah. Thank you for your input, Zoe.
Yeah, not a problem. All right, I'm going to start this next one in like 2 seconds after my dog stops barking.
Hello everyone. My topic tonight is about artificial intelligence or AI in automotive industry. I'm going to focus on understanding autonomous vehicle, how data are processed on autonomous vehicle, perception and understanding of the vehicle environment, localization and mapping in autonomous vehicle. Prediction assessment of risks on the road, security measures and emergency management, real-time adaptation and learning, AI ethic and regulation consideration. Understanding autonomous vehicles. Self-driving vehicles are vehicles capable of navigating and operating without human intervention. This vehicle uses a combination of sensors such as camera, radar, GPS, advanced control system, often integrated with artificial intelligence algorithms to perceive the surrounding and make decisions based on them. Self-driving vehicles are becoming more popular these days. Understanding this role of AI is very important. Sensor fusion is a critical process in autonomous vehicles that involves integrating data from multiple sensors. They help to create a comprehensive and accurate representation of this vehicle's surrounding. AI-based sensor technique help the vehicle generate a real-time understanding its environment. Data processing is important in AI. It includes data cleaning, which involves assuring the integrity of data set. Good quality data by identifying missing data are used to generate reliable and accurate sensor reading. Data also must be normalized over repetition of data. Scaling help also to avoid bias in data that could impact the accuracy of the fusion process. Data also must be good quality, help to verify the accuracy and reliability of sensor data, including error detection, error correction, and validation check to assure that only high quality data is used for fusion process. Error analysis is helped to implement a correction technique to minimize accuracy and assure that the mesh data accuracy represents the real world environment. Perception and understanding of the vehicle environment. AI algorithm enable autonomous vehicle to recognize and interpret various elements of the environment, including other vehicle, pedestrian, or traffic sign. Advanced computing, computer vision, and deep learning technique are used to detect, classify, and track objects, allowing the vehicle to make informed decisions based on its perception of the environment. Object detection and classification. The vehicle can recognize objects on the road. The AI-based computer vision algorithm is used to detect and classify various objects near the vehicle, which may other vehicle, pedestrian, and distinct different type of object structure. Pedestrian. Algorithm based on deep learning make it possible to detect pedestrian or cyclists to guarantee the safety of road user, predict their movement, and adjust vehicle driving behavior accordingly. Localization and mapping in autonomous vehicles. Localization and mapping are essential components of autonomous vehicle system, enabling vehicle to navigate and operate accurately in complex and dynamic environments. They allow autonomous vehicle to determine a position, create detailed map on the environment. The integration of data from various sensors such as GPS help to accurately determine the position and orientation of the vehicle in relation to its surrounding. AI-based 3D reconstruction. This technique uses that data from deep camera to create detailed and accurate 3D representation, allowing the vehicle to navigate and interact with an environment. Location of difficult environments such as a tunnel or area provided by GPS help mapping capability in various environmental conditions. Prediction and assessment of risk on the road. Predicting and assessing potential risks that may be present on the road is essential for autonomous vehicle systems. They enable vehicles to anticipate and react to potential risk and danger, predict the behavior of the other vehicle or pedestrian. This prediction includes trajectory prediction. The use of AI makes it possible to anticipate the future trajectory and behavior of the other vehicle, pedestrian near the autonomous vehicle. Anomaly detection. Anomaly detection algorithm helps identify and classify circumstances of anomal behavior in the driving environment. Adaptive risk strategies. Integration of adaptive risk mitigation strategy allows the vehicle to dynamically adjust its driving behavior. Security measures and emergency management. AI plays an important role in implementing safety critical system to deal with unexpected breakdown or emergency and prioritize passenger safety. This measure involves emergency and interventions. A vehicle can react quickly to unforeseen events such as sudden obstacle, sensor failure, or adverse weather condition, break down and control the system to guarantee the safety of the passenger and the road user. System hacking. Implementing AI-based cybersecurity measures to protect vehicle control system from internal threat and potential hacking, assuring the integrity and security of vehicle operation. Real-time adaptation and learning. The continuous improvement of autonomous vehicle system allowing vehicle to dynamically adjust the driving capability based on real-time data and user feedback. Machine learning technique enable autonomous vehicle to adapt to changing driving condition, changing route, identification of road condition, travel time, traffic congestion, user feedback and preference. Many autonomous cars like Tesla use user feedback and preference to personalize the driving experience and adapt to the user's specific requirements and driving styles, creating personalized driving profile to improve performance, passenger comfort, and satisfaction. Adaptive control system. Self-driving cars have adaptive control system that adjust vehicle control parameters such as steering, acceleration, and braking. Ethical and regulatory concern of AI driving autonomous vehicles. Self-driving car raise complex questions related to decision making in critical situations, attribution of responsibilities, data privacy, and cybersecurity. Among the concerns, we have algorithmic bias. It is important to assure the fair treatment of all road users. Autonomous vehicle data security. It is important that these cars have comprehensive and effective cybersecurity protocol to identify potential vulnerabilities and mitigate risk. Thank you.
Nice job. Very good. Does anybody have any questions? Charles.
Sorry, I hit the wrong button. My computer lagged when I went to hit something.
Okay. Okay, Nikki, you ready?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, go for it.
Can everybody see my screen?
We sure can. Yes.
All right, perfect. Hey, hello, everyone. My name is Nikki Lindorf, and I am here to discuss the importance of cybersecurity policies for enterprise resilience. First, let's take a look at cybersecurity in general and why it's so important. The world has become increasingly interconnected through technology, making organizations and individuals vulnerable to cyber threats. Cybersecurity and robust security policies are important for their role in things like protecting sensitive data. Businesses and individuals store vast amounts of sensitive information online, including personal data, financial records, and intellectual property. Robust security measures protect this information from unauthorized access, theft, and misuse. It can also help with preventing financial losses. Cyber attacks can result in significant financial losses for organizations, including theft of funds, ransom demands, and costs associated with fixing the damage caused. Strong security policies can minimize the risk of financial loss due to cyber incidents. Safeguarding reputation and customer trust. A cybersecurity breach can severely damage an organization's reputation, eroding customer trust and leading to a loss of business. Implementing robust security policies demonstrates a commitment to protecting customer data and maintaining a secure environment, enhancing trust among stakeholders. It can also help with ensuring regulatory compliance. There are various laws and regulations require organizations to protect sensitive information, such as personally identifiable information, or PII, healthcare records, and financial data. Security policies can help organizations meet regulatory requirements, reducing the risk of legal penalties and reputational damage. It can also help business continuity. Cyber attacks, including ransomware and distributed denial of service attacks, can disrupt an organization's operations, leading to downtime, loss of productivity, and potentially halting critical services. Strong security measures help mitigate such disruptions and ensure business continuity. It can also guard against intellectual theft. Many organizations rely on intellectual property as a competitive advantage. These security policies would protect against industrial espionage, trade secret theft, and unauthorized access to valuable intellectual assets. Finally, they can help adapt to evolving threats. The cyber threat landscape continuously evolves, with new methods and techniques emerging regularly. By implementing robust security policies, organizations can stay vigilant, detect emerging threats, and adapt defenses accordingly to mitigate risk effectively. Now, we discussed that the threat landscape is always evolving, but what does that mean? The current cybersecurity landscape is characterized by an ever-evolving and increasingly sophisticated threat landscape, with cyber attacks becoming more frequent, complex, and damaging. So here's a few key aspects to keep in mind. Cyber threats are on the rise. The number and sophistication of cyber threats continue to increase. Organizations face a wide range of threats, including malware, ransomware, phishing, social engineering, insider threats, and advanced persistent threats. There's also targeted attacks on organizations. Attackers are targeting organizations of all sizes and across all industries, including government entities and healthcare providers. There's nation-state sponsored attacks and cyber criminal groups that frequently target high-value organizations to steal sensitive data, disrupt operation, or gain unauthorized access. Rapidly evolving attack techniques. Cyber criminals constantly develop new attack techniques to bypass security measures. The use of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and automation in cybercrime allows attackers to detect vulnerabilities, exploit them, and launch attacks at a scale and speed previously unseen. Another key aspect is supply chain attacks. Cybercriminals are targeting the supply chain to compromise trusted vendors to gain unauthorized access to the target organization. These attacks have severe consequences as they exploit the trust between organizations and their partners, enabling attackers to infiltrate multiple targets. We also face cloud security challenges. As organizations increasingly rely on cloud services and infrastructure, there are new security challenges. Securing cloud environments requires effective configuration management, access control, data protection, and continuous monitoring to mitigate risks and ensure the security of data. The Internet of Things has also introduced new cybersecurity risks. Many IoT devices lack robust security features, making them incredibly vulnerable to compromise. Attackers can exploit these devices to gain unauthorized access to networks or to launch DDoS attacks. There's also data breaches and privacy concerns. Data breaches continue to plague organizations, resulting in the exposure of personal and sensitive information. As a result, privacy concerns and data protection regulations, such as the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, and the California Consumer Privacy Act, or CCPA, have become prominent. There's also a significant shortage of skilled cybersecurity professionals worldwide. The increasing demand for skilled individuals outpaces the supply, making it challenging for organizations to build and maintain effective cybersecurity teams. Finally, the importance of a proactive defense. The reactive approach to cybersecurity is no longer sufficient. Organizations must adopt a proactive defense strategy, implementing robust security measures such as threat intelligence, continuous monitoring, penetration testing, user awareness and training, and incident response planning. Let's take a look at some statistics. We have seen a general trend of increased cybercrime complaints and monetary losses reported to the FBI over the past 5 years. As we can see from the chart provided from Security Weekly, even though there was a slight decline in complaints of cybercrime recorded with the FBI from 2021 to 2022, you can see that 847,000 versus 800,000, the monetary losses increased from $7 billion to over $10 billion just in that 1 year. This discrepancy might be due to the tendency of companies to just pay the ransoms to restore systems. For these larger companies, that's often the easiest way to restore access quickly. Implementing comprehensive cybersecurity policies offers several benefits to organizations. Here's some of the key advantages. The protection of sensitive data. Cybersecurity policies can help safeguard sensitive information like customer data and intellectual property or financial records. By implementing these policies and security measures, organizations can prevent unauthorized access, data breaches, and the theft or misuse of sensitive data. Adaptability to evolving threats. Comprehensive cybersecurity policies help organizations stay vigilant and adaptable to emerging threats. By continually evaluating and updating security measures, organizations can mitigate those risks associated with new cyber threats and adapt their defenses accordingly. It also leads to increased business opportunities. Demonstrating strong security measures can give organizations a competitive advantage. Clients, partners, and customers prioritize working with organizations that prioritize security and protect their interests. Implementing comprehensive cybersecurity policies can even open up new business opportunities, partnerships, and collaborations. Compliance with regulations. Cybersecurity policies can help organizations meet regulatory requirements. Many industries have specific regulations governing the protection of sensitive data, such as PII, healthcare records, and financial data. By implementing the appropriate security measures, organizations can ensure compliance, avoid penalties, and build a reputation as a trusted and responsible entity. Finally, the mitigation of financial losses. Cybersecurity incidents have devastating financial implications for organizations, including theft of funds, loss of business due to reputational damage, legal fees, regulatory fines, and however much they had to pay to get their data back. Comprehensive cybersecurity policies can minimize the risk of financial losses by reducing the likelihood and impact of a cyber attack. Conversely, inadequate cybersecurity measures can have severe consequences for organizations. Here are some of the potential outcomes for not prioritizing cybersecurity. The first one, data breaches. Inadequate security can lead to data breaches where unauthorized individuals gain access to sensitive information. This can result in reputational damage, legal repercussion, financial losses, and regulatory fines. Operational disruptions. Cybersecurity incidents can disrupt business operations, leading to downtime, loss of productivity, and service disruptions. Ransomware attacks, DDoS attacks, or other malicious activities can render systems or networks unavailable, causing significant financial losses. Reputational damage. Poor cybersecurity practices can damage an organization's reputation in the industry and marketplace. A data breach or insecurity or a security incident can tarnish an organization's reputation and erode customer trust. The loss of customer confidence can lead to negative reviews and decreased sales. Rebuilding trust and reputation can be a costly and time-consuming process, and this can lead to lost business opportunities, decreased customer confidence, and challenges attracting new clients or partners. There's also legal liabilities and regulatory penalties. Inadequate cybersecurity can result in legal liabilities if customer or employee data is compromised. I don't know how many of you remember the Target breach, but I think I still get free credit monitoring from that breach. Organizations may face lawsuits, liability claims, and potential financial damage. Additionally, failing to protect sensitive customer data can lead to lawsuits from affected individuals seeking compensation for damages caused by the security breach. Finally, financial losses. Cybersecurity incidents are costly. Organizations may face financial losses due to the initial theft, the disruption of operation, loss of business, and costs associated with the incident response, remediation, and recovery. A robust security policy framework encompasses several fundamental elements. These elements include policy development, where you establish a clear and comprehensive cybersecurity policy, which is crucial for guiding the organization's security practices and ensuring consistency throughout the organization. Risk management. A cybersecurity policy framework should include a risk management strategy that identifies and prioritizes potential risks, vulnerabilities, and threats. This involves conducting regular risk assessments, implementing appropriate controls, and establishing incident response and recovery procedures. Implementing strong access controls ensures that only authorized individuals can access sensitive resources and data. Another fundamental element is data protection. A cybersecurity policy framework should address the protection of sensitive data. This may include encrypting data both in transit and at rest, establishing data classification guidelines, implementing secure data storage and backup procedures, and defining appropriate data handling and disposal methods. Incident response. The policy framework should clearly define the organization's incident response procedures. This includes establishing an incident reporting mechanism, defining roles and responsibilities, conducting forensic investigations, and establishing communication channels with relevant stakeholders. Employee training and awareness is incredibly important. Providing regular training and awareness programs helps educate employees about cybersecurity risks and best practices. This includes educating employees about phishing attacks, social engineering techniques, password hygiene, secure browsing habits, and the importance of reporting suspicious activity. security monitoring and detection. Establishing a robust security monitoring capability allows organizations to detect and respond to potential security incidents in a timely manner. This includes the implementation of intrusion detection and prevention systems, security information and event management, SIEM tools, and continuous threat monitoring. Incident reporting and communication are also very important. Clearly defining the reporting and communication procedures for security incidents is critical. The policy framework should outline how incidents are reported internally and externally, who the stakeholders are, and when and how to communicate with affected parties. Compliance and regulatory requirements. Organizations must comply with industry-specific regulations and standards related to cybersecurity. A cybersecurity framework should include measures to address and comply with relevant regulations, such as the GDPR or the Payment Card Industry Data Security Standard, or HIPAA. And finally, regular review and improvement. A robust cybersecurity policy framework should include provisions for regular review, evaluation, and improvement of the policies and procedures. This ensures that the framework remains up to date and aligned with any changing security risks and industry best practices. Speaking of industry best practices, there are many resources available to companies to give guidance on policy creations. For example, the NIST SP800 series is an excellent resource for policies and cybersecurity. In fact, as you can see here, the NIST SP800-12 Revision 1 provides instructions on how to create policies, what they should cover, and gives recommendations on what policies companies should consider using. As you can see from the images here, NIST discusses a strong, overarching policy combined with several smaller issue-specific policies that go into more granular detail. They also recommend reviewing the policies on a regular basis and updating as needed. The issue-specific policies should cover every technology the company utilizes. So let's go over a couple of policies that companies can adopt to strengthen their security posture. There are several recommended policies that organizations should have in place to strengthen their cybersecurity posture. In no specific order, these policies include an acceptable use policy. This policy outlines the acceptable and expected use of organizations' technology resources, including computers, networks, internet access, software, any other technology. It establishes a guideline for employees, contractors, and other authorized users to ensure appropriate and secure use of these resources. Password policies set guidelines for creating and managing strong and secure passwords. It typically includes requirements such as password complexity, minimum length, regular password changes, and prohibits the sharing of passwords. A data classification policy defines how an organization's data should be categorized based on its sensitivity, criticality, and establishes guidelines for handling and protecting different levels of sensitive information, including personal data, confidential business data, and classified or regulated data. A mobile device policy addresses the use of personal and company-owned mobile devices, such as smartphones and tablets within the organization. It outlines security requirements such as enabling device encryption, implementing data backup, and remote wipe capabilities. An incident response policy provides guidance on how the organization should respond to and manage security incidents and breaches. It defines the roles and responsibilities, incident escalation procedures, communication channels, and outlines the steps for incident containment. A security awareness training policy outlines the organization's commitment to providing ongoing cybersecurity awareness and training programs to all employees. It can mandate regular training sessions, awareness campaigns, and simulated phishing exercises to educate employees about current threats and best practices. A bring-your-own-device policy governs the use of personally owned devices in the workplace and outlines security requirements for employees who choose to use their own devices for work purposes. A remote access policy addresses the secure access to organizations' resources by remote employees or external contractors. It defines the security requirements for remote access, such as the use of a virtual private network, multi-factor authentication, or secure data transmission protocols. Data privacy policy establishes guidelines for ensuring compliance with privacy regulations and protecting personal information collected by the organization. It outlines the controls, procedures, and safeguards required to handle, store, transmit, and disclose personal data appropriately. Finally, vendor management policy. This policy defines the requirements for assessing and managing the cybersecurity risks associated with third-party vendors. It outlines the criteria for vendor selection, security assessments, contractual obligations, and ongoing monitoring of vendor security practices. Here are some helpful places to find additional information about the topics that we have discussed today. And thank you, everyone. Feel free to reach out to me via email listed here. I can provide a copy of the presentation if anybody needs. And does anybody have any questions?
Nice job, Nikki. That was really good. I'm teaching a cybersecurity class right now, Google class, and all that information would be great help. So good job. Does anyone have any questions? Go ahead.
It was going to be plans and policies, but it got to be a little bit too long.
Yeah, lots of information, right?
Yeah, I timed myself on the first four slides and I was like, oh goodness, I'm going to have to cut something.
Well, great job. Great job, everyone, tonight. I want to welcome the new interns. They came with you, right, Nikki? I can't see. I'm on my phone.
Yes, a lot of them came over.
All right. So welcome, everyone. I think all of us in here were where you're at right now. For me, it was 6 years ago. I just stuck around. I loved it so much. But my name is Marcia, and you'll be seeing me in chat, and I want to welcome everyone. I'm sure the orientation was great. I'm sure Nikki gave you lots of great information, but you have team leads and chat to help with any of your questions. So please feel free to reach out. Don't be scared. Everybody is nervous in the beginning, and by the third week, you're completely got this. And you'll say, I don't know what I was confused about. So it happens to everyone. That is all we have for tonight, unless somebody has something they want to add. Okay. All right. Well, everyone, have a great night. We will resume our regularly scheduled meetings next week. So see you back here, or not back here, but on Tuesday we have, or Monday you have your department meetings. Tuesday we have our AHOD. So everyone have a great night and we'll see you soon. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night.